This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Jesus is said to have turned water into wine because wine is what was needed at a wedding feast. Perhaps if he were here today, he would be turning wine into water because the need for water in many parts of the world is critical. More than 1 billion people worldwide suffer from lack of access to water, something most of us take for granted. And even if they have access to this life-sustaining fluid, it doesn't mean the water is suitable for drinking or bathing or washing clothes, for that matter. Armed with that knowledge and with the realization that millions of people die preventable deaths every year due to lack of access to clean water, a young North Carolinian set out to do something about it by doing what he does best, pouring drinks and making music. Doc Hendley is a bartender by trade who acted on his own impulse to help and, as a result, changed lives around the world. We asked him to share his remarkable story with us, and he joins us for the hour. Welcome.
Thank you for having me here, Mike.
Nice to have you with us. I have to ask you this because the executive producer wants to know the answer to this question.
You got it. Shoot.
Here you are, a young guy. You're in your 20s, right?
30 years old. Just turned 30.
Just turned 30.
Right.
And your name is Doc Hendley. Now, the only other Doc I know about is Doc Holliday. From the Wild West.
Right.
Why, you're not a doctor.
No, I'm not.
I don't believe you have a doctorate.
No, I definitely don't.
Why Doc?
I like to say it has to do with I'm just an amazing shot, so they named me after Doc Holliday. I'd love to be able to say that, but yeah. It's not the case. I've actually had the name ever since I can remember, before I can remember. My real name is Dixon, and my sister couldn't say my name Dixon.
Mm-hmm.
So actually she called me Dick Doc. That was the name that I got as a young child, mm-hmm. and my family somehow, again, before I even remember, they started just calling me Doc. They dropped the first part, left the Doc, and I don't think Dick Doc would go over so well. Yeah. As a kind of a nickname nowadays.
Well, it's a good name. Doc is a good name, and it will serve you well, particularly as you age.
I hope so. It's done well. Definitely done well for me.
Now, you founded Wine to Water, and we'll talk about how you came about doing that. But I've read several different figures about how much money you have raised, that which you've now applied to bringing water to water short areas. $25,000 is one of the figures, but I'm sure that's changed.
That has changed. And actually, we're getting to the point where we're doing that in just one or two events now because of our the amount of exposure that we've gotten this last year has been huge. Our very first event that we held, which was literally just weeks after the idea came in late 2003, the very first event that we held raised almost $6,000. It's just kind of thrown together in a nightclub in Raleigh, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. This would have been January of 2004. And that's when I was like, wow, here's a group of people that they're just looking to be involved with something bigger than just the nightlife crowd and whatever that was going on. And it was amazing to see them respond to that. And that's when I knew that night in January 2004, I knew Wine to Water was going to be more than just a few events in a few different bars. I knew it was going to be something big.
Before that event, before there was an organization,
mm-hmm.
Which is a 501(c) nonprofit.
Right, right.
Before all of that, there was an idea. Where did the idea, when did you become interested in the problem? When did you become aware of the problem?
It was developing. The idea for water kind of came a little bit after. I actually really became interested in my clientele as a bartender. I really became interested in the guy on the other end of the bar or the girl on the other end of the bar, their stories, their lives. I became very involved relationally with people that were coming in and out of my bars.
That's what a good bartender does, isn't it?
Exactly. And the whole point is to get to know people and get to know their thoughts, what they're feeling. And I really felt like people wanted to be a part of something bigger than just sitting on the same stool, drinking the same drink, paying the same tab every day at happy hour after they've gone to work and they go home to their families. And it was just this routine life that I'd heard about. I'm like, what? I mean, I just saw a desire for them to be a part of something. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what it was, but I began brainstorming. I began thinking, what can I do to offer them something else than just to come sit on the stool and just have a beer and tell the same story every day? And the idea came. I was on Christmas break, cause I was finishing up my degree at NC State University as well at the time in 2003. I was laying in my bed one night and honestly, I I rolled over. I couldn't sleep. I pulled up a pad and a piece of paper and a pencil, and the first thing I wrote down was wine to water. And I just began jotting down a whole page full of notes on, you know, giving the service industry crowd, the bar crowd, a chance to be a part of something. Because a lot of these organizations that are out there today, a lot of them are religious-based in ministries, and we do consider ourselves a ministry, but the difference is I'm the type of guy that's kind of sick and tired of the norm. And I really love the crowd. I was a bartender for years and also a server before that. I love the nightlife crowd. I love that crowd. That, to me, is my crowd. And I felt like that because most ministries, for some reason, keep that crowd at arm's length, I'm like, well, that's my people. That's who I want to be involved with this organization.
So this is, in your mind, this is a religious-based organization?
We do consider ourselves a ministry. We're founded on the principles of Christ, which in my mind aren't going around beating people over the head with Scripture. Actually, Christ, if you look at his life, he actually went and met people's physical needs first. He did that first all the time. And so we want to do that as an organization. We want to meet people's needs for clean water first and foremost.
You have to eat and drink and be well before you can concentrate on the other things.
That's true. Very true. So we really feel like that meeting people's physical needs that's our number one goal, is to reach people for clean water.
But where do you think the idea came? You're rolling around in your bed, you can't sleep, you pick up a pad, you start writing down ideas about wine to water. Why? Where did that come from?
I honestly can't tell you. I really don't know. It may sound cliche to say that, you know, God gave him the idea. I really don't know. I don't have the answer to that. I don't know if it was something I saw and then it came into my mind, or if God actually gave me this, you know, vision for an organization. I can't tell you.
I mean, did you know the proportions of the water crisis in the places that you have been since this idea sprang into your head?
I didn't know anything about water or the water crisis until after I began writing down all this information, because on that pad, I remember writing down below it, why water? ?
Mm-hmm.
Immediately, I stayed up that whole night. Immediately, I went down to the internet. This is end of 2003. Began researching water. That whole night, I was distraught because I began seeing 1.1 billion people don't have access to clean water. I began seeing things like in East Africa, 70% of all the hospital visits in East Africa are due to unclean water. We could take out 70% of the people that are there on the sick beds if they just had clean water. And what really upset me the most, besides those astonishing figures, is that nobody really knew about it. I didn't know about it.
Right.
None of the people that I worked around knew about it. We all know about the HIV/AIDS crisis. We all know about famine and food. We all know about war and disasters. But I had no idea that water was killing more children than AIDS and malaria and tuberculosis combined, which are the other big three below water.
What's your degree in? I'm just curious.
Communications, actually. And I didn't think that I was going to use it for anything.
Because, you know, somebody who gets an idea like you got, the wine to water thing, and you're a bartender, and you think, well, maybe I can turn to my customers and get them involved in something meaningful that will give them a purpose here, or make them feel good about themselves and feel that they're involved. And we'll raise some money, and we'll write the check, and we'll send it off.
Right, right.
But you didn't do that. You have gone from being a bartender to a public works engineer. I mean,
that's a good way to put it.
I mean, how did that happen? When did you decide that it wasn't enough just to have a fundraiser and then send a check off to somebody?
That's a great question. I was holding the events. Let me give you a little background. So I had the idea early 2004 in January. We held our first event. By that summer, we had raised, I don't know the exact number, but probably $15,000-$20,000, decent amount of money, and I had no idea where to put it. I had no idea how to get it to this water. That
so people just giving you money,
yeah,
in the hopes that you turn it over to somebody.
Yeah, and I told him, every single dime is going to go. Yeah. I don't know how or where, but it's going to go to water. And
they must really like you.
They trust me. And so then I had this obligation. All right, well, I'm going to make sure this gets to water.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll volunteer. I did this completely on my own time. And I went to there's an organization in Boone, North Carolina, called Samaritan's Purse.
Right.
They actually have a great, very successful well drilling and water program all around the world. They do a lot of great things globally. And so I thought, well, maybe I can meet with someone that knows about their well drilling, maybe some their head driller or something, and just give the money to them with the stipulation that it's all going to water, not going to anything else. So I got a meeting with a guy there up in Boone who was their head well driller forever in East Africa, who actually at the time, I didn't know it, but he became head of all their projects by that time that I met with him.
Right.
And I had no idea that I'm meeting with this high profile guy. All I was a bartender trying to give some money that I had raised for water. I sit down with this guy for an hour. We talk. He asks, you know, what are you here for? I said, well, I have some money. I want it to go to water. Well, why did you raise this money? Well, I wanted to, for the bar crowd to have something to grab hold of, but then I really became passionate about the water crisis in the meantime. And look, I'm just doing this all volunteer, and I just want to know that it's going to the right place. Well, he kept grilling me on all these questions. Why did you do this? Why are you into this? And it actually turned into an interview, and he said, all right, I tell you what, why don't you keep that money? Keep it. Don't give it to us. How about I give you a job, send you anywhere in the world that you want to go, and we'll show you, teach you, train you how to do this water work. And when you get there, you use that money so that you can write back to all your donors and say, I saw this go to these people, and here's some pictures, and here's some stories.
You know, $20,000 is not an insignificant amount of money. It's not something you would just go, well, go do it yourself. Why do you think he took that approach with you?
I honestly think after getting to know him, and actually he is now on our board, still a Samaritan's Purse, but he's on our board and a very close mentor of mine.
Is this Coy Isaacs?
Kenny Isaacs, his father. Kenny, I think maybe had a little bit of similar background that I did. I think we share a lot of things, and I think he saw potential in me where a lot of people didn't. A lot of people, especially in the ministry world, they see a bartender that's got tattoos all over his arm that drinks beer and wine. Well, that guy can't be of use. Well, I think he saw something different. And I think he wanted to give me a shot and say, well, let's see how this kid does. At that time, I'm, 25 years old?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, where do you want to go in the world? And I said, well, where's the worst place? I want to go to the worst place because I want to be of use. And he said, well, there's two places right now. I'll be in touch in a month. The two were Afghanistan or Darfur, Sudan. And he called me back in a month. He said, Darfur is really blowing up, and we don't have anybody on the ground there right now. Will you be willing to go there and be one of the first people on the ground in Darfur for Samaritan's Purse? I said, yes, sir. I'm happy to do that. I'd be honored to do that. And he sent me, and we had access to where I could send the money through when we needed it in Darfur. And the thing is money kept coming in for Wine to Water when I was there because I was writing emails back about what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by the end of that year, without me even doing one event, we more than doubled what I had already raised. We raised close to $50,000 just from emails about what was going on.
I want to talk about Darfur with you in a second. But before we do that, we've been talking about Wine to Water, and you're here in town to do a Wine to Water event. But I want to find out what that is. You just don't set up a tin can on the edge of the bar and say, if you want to give water to people in other parts of the world, put
right.
some money in the hat here. How do you do it?
Well, the beauty about our events is not there's not one the same, but there's kind of a skeleton outline of what the one would look like. You could do two things. We either encourage people that if they want to be involved in a new wine event, they can do one at their home and do a home wine tasting. And if I'm not out of the country or somewhere else, I love to show up and just talk and be a part of it. Or at a restaurant, if you know a restaurant owner or someone that would want to do something like that. Again, if I'm there, if I'm able to, I'd love to be there or a representative.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole idea is that if we're involved and it's in our kind of geographic area, we try to provide all the wine for the event. A restaurant owner or a homeowner would provide the location and some food for the event. People just get together, have a good time, no money, no strings attached, and if they feel led, then they can give to our organization.
Doc Hendley is the founder of Wine to Water. We're going to talk more about that and about his experiences in Darfur and other parts of the world and where that money goes. It's kind of a unique thing. When we continue, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks made possible in part this morning by Classic Graphics and Opus Direct, from print and distribution services to data management. Classic Graphics, a technology-driven company accustomed to managing change in a fast-paced environment. And by Red Sky Gallery, offering fine art, including painting, sculpture, and jewelry, as well as artistic gifts for any occasion at three locations, East Boulevard in Dilworth, Blakeney in South Charlotte, and downtown in the epicenter, redskygallery.com. Tomorrow on this program at 9 o'clock, we take a look at newspapers and the role they have played traditionally in our democracy, a role that was fairly strong through most of the 20th century, but the 21st century ushered in the electronic age, and although newspapers migrated content to the web, it's no secret that they are in a little bit of trouble. We'll take a look at the evolving role of newspapers and the news tomorrow at 9.
President Obama's speech on health care, analysis of his primetime address to Congress and the nation, and how it could shape debate over a possible overhaul of the health care and health insurance industries. The Diane Rehm Show, Thursday.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on listener-funded 90.7 FM, WFAE, your NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Doc Hendley, the founder of Wine to Water. He's a young guy from originally from Raleigh. Is that right?
I started the organization there, but I'm kind of all over. Greenville, South Carolina, right. Kind of the main area.
So a Carolinian. And I think you're based out of Boone now. Is that
that's correct.
Correct?
We're up in Boone.
Wine to Water is an organization that raises money to build the infrastructure to provide clean water to people in various parts of the world that have limited or no access to it. One of the figures that he gave out in the last segment, 70% of all hospital visits in Africa are due to unclean water. Water and sanitation problems claim more lives through disease than any war claims through guns, which is an astounding figure to me. And every 15 seconds, a child dies from water-related illness. You didn't know any of this when you first got the idea for this, but obviously when you found it out and told others, it inspired them to want to be part of these Wine to Water events that you have been doing that have brought you some success in terms of being able to do what you set out to do and also brought you some notoriety. You've been on Larry King Live. You've been on a lot of different shows. How did they find you, and what's been the upshot of being of getting that kind of exposure? That's national exposure,
right? And that's been huge. It's something that definitely no money can buy. Getting that kind of exposure for our organization. It started. We began gaining national exposure slowly over the last 5 years, but it exploded when a old friend of mine from the bar industry, who's now still a great friend of mine, who still lives in Raleigh, her name is Tasha Sullivan. She works in with women who are sexually abused. Mm-hmm. So I'm very lucky to be surrounded by people that are doing great things. She saw CNN Heroes, a show about regular old people that do extraordinary things. Saw the show.
And you were one of them.
And decided she wanted to nominate me for
I
that.
Okay.
We were friends when I was a bartender, when I was very rough around the edges, when I, you know, my direction was, you know, whether I was working or whether I wasn't working, it was in the bar. Mm-hmm. And she saw that, and we kept in contact through living in Darfur and different areas of the world. And she watched as the organization and things began to change in my life, and decided to nominate me for that very prestigious award. And somehow, out of how many ever thousands of nominations that they got, they decided to choose me, which was huge exposure for us.
I want to talk about Darfur, but here you are. You've described yourself as a guy who loves the bar scene, who loved the people who went out clubbing at night, and you were part of that both as a spectator and as a person facilitating that on the other side of the bar. Was there ever a moment in time in those first experiences that you had in these other parts of the world where you thought, what am I doing? This is not my life. This is not who I am. These are not my people. This is an experience that is nothing like anything I've ever been prepared to do. What have I done?
That's a great question. I felt like that a lot, but always before going to a place. Like before Darfur, obviously I was a nervous wreck. And maybe even when I'm stepping off the plane and I'm walking down the runway and I'm looking around, I'm in a completely well over 90% Islam culture in the north of Sudan and where I was in Darfur, well over 90%. So I'm surrounded by Islam. I'm surrounded by Sudanese people. Something that firsthand I thought, man, what am I doing? But it doesn't take a couple days and a few cups of coffee, of jebana, or of tea, of shai with someone, and a few good conversations to realize that person, I don't care race, religion, color, anything, that person is a human being, and he's no different than me. He's no different than the guys that I love back home at the pub. He's no different than me. And sitting down with a cup of coffee or a cup of tea with those guys just the first few days made me realize this is my home. We are all humans, and we deserve the right to have clean water.
According to CNN, you found yourself in parts of Sudan, which is where Darfur is, racked by civil war and too dangerous for the United Nations aid workers to be there.
Correct.
There you were. Why were you there?
I had the luxury, especially since I was using money that I had raised. I didn't have any red tape. I didn't have any type of bureaucratic hoops to jump through. I didn't have that. The UN definitely has UN no-go zones for a good reason. They're quite insecure in these areas. But obviously, in those areas, the people groups that live there have the biggest need because they're not getting reached out to by aid, because most aid organizations are tied to the UN in one way or another. And so they follow that UN no-go zone quite strictly. Well, I wasn't tied to the UN.
But didn't you think it was wise to follow that no-go zone dictum?
Or? Well, maybe so, but I've constantly throughout my life found myself making decisions that maybe most people would label as not wise or not the norm. But it's where I felt led. I didn't want to be where everybody else was giving water. There was other organizations giving water there. I wanted to be where there was no water.
When a young guy from America, Christian, white, comes in by, how many people were there with you?
When I first got there, we kind of arrived at the same time. There was two other guys.
Okay. Comes in with two other guys into this part of the world that everybody else has forsaken. What's the reaction of the people to you? Do they think you have a scheme that you're trying to perpetrate on them? Do they accept you with open arms? Do they get what you were trying to do? Did you know what you were trying to do? Because this is the first time you've done it.
Right. I knew I wanted to bring him water. Again, at that time, I still had no idea how I was going to do it. I was there learning and trying to figure that out. But the people were absolutely amazing. The Darfuri people, the Sudanese people I met in Khartoum, whether it was a black African person in Darfur that was being attacked by people that were supported by the actual government of Sudan, or whether it was people in Khartoum that are maybe even labeled as a part of that, I felt a connection with those people. I loved those people. I loved hanging out with them. I don't care what religion, what background they had. I could care less. I fell in love with the Darfuri people, with the people of Sudan, with that Muslim culture, actually. I absolutely fell in love with them, and they embraced me.
But what did you tell them you were there to do? To bring them water?
I did, but, you know, I told them differently than most other people, because this is where I began to see a vision for our organization and how we were going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
I constantly recognize these, I won't name any names, but massive organizations coming in with just, you know, convoys of land cruisers, white land cruisers, flying their flags, saying, we're from the West and we're here to save you. And, I did things differently, because usually it was just me going out to these UN no-go zones, maybe two vehicles going in there. And these other folks would go in, drop some stuff off, do their work, and then leave and go back to their little safe haven in this village and their nice little compound. And I didn't feel like working that way. I felt like getting to know the people that I'm going to help first. So that, A, they trust me. And that was important in these UN no-go zones, because there's a lot of conflict and a lot of lawlessness. So you have to win the trust over these people. But B, I kind of looked at it the same way as bartending. The most important thing really about that is building the relationship with the person you're trying to provide a service to, or whatever it is. You are never going to be good at being a bartender or anything else in this life, I don't reckon, unless you do your best to build relationships with people around you. And so I approached water that way. I didn't go right in, march in with my flags and my trucks and say, I'm here to give you water, and then leave. I went in and got to know the commanders of these rebel armies. I got to know a lot of the soldiers. I sat down with them and had dinner with them, slept in their compounds with their families, played with their children, got to know their way of life, and then said, I'm here because I want to find out if there's any water needs in your area. And then, this well's been broken for 10 years. Some organization came and put it in 10 years ago, didn't teach us about how to fix it, and so it's been sitting there broken. Okay, well, I can help you with that, and I'll leave you some tools and teach you how to fix it. Okay, well, that was easy. Yeah. We've had some serious cholera issues. All right, I'll be back in a week on a UN helicopter with chlorine tablets for you so you can clean your water source and get an immediate fix. And then I want to talk to you about water filtration or rainwater containment.
How did you know you'd be back in a week in a UN helicopter? How did you know that?
By that time, after I'd kind of gotten seasoned and learned, I had some really great contacts in the UN that helped out. One of the reasons why we had to start flying in a UN helicopter for a while is because I actually I had quite a few run-ins. The first one was in February of 2005. my convoy was hijacked. He pulled all my men out of our two trucks and put them all out execution style on the side of the road and smashed them up with their AK-47s in the head, and they attempted to get me out of my truck. I refused, they kept saying over and over in Arabic, because I was learning it pretty well at that point, that we're all going to die and all this crazy stuff. Well, they let us live. Obviously, I'm still here. And they say, if you ever come back here again, we're going to kill you. Don't come back and help these rebels, because they're the people we're trying to kill. They're our enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And so through that and the other UN security situations, they had decided, all right, well, it's UN no-go zone, but we'll fly you up there and drop you off. So I'd have like a horse or a donkey waiting on me, and I'd ride around in a donkey with some chlorine tablets on the back and do that kind of stuff or whatever. Well, then it kind of got worse, because I did decide to drive back to the area that they told me not to come back again. I don't make always the wisest decisions. And they held their end of the bargain. They definitely attempted to kill us this next time. In April of 2005, they hijacked the first time. They ambushed my convoy that time, and there were quite a few gunmen on the sides of the road waiting, and they shot my vehicle quite a bit, shot us up pretty good. Again, very miraculously, I was not hit. My other guy in the vehicle wasn't hit either. It was quite a sketchy situation, but we made it through.
And yet you kept going back.
I did.
You saw children in Darfur who walked 3 hours each way.
I did.
To bring water to their families. That's hard to imagine. It sounds like the old tales that you hear from your parents about walking barefoot uphill both ways.
Yeah, uphill both ways.
In the snow to go to school. But this is true.
This is true. There are places, your average is going to be a lot of times around 2 hours, and there are definitely places where there's a 3-hour walk, especially during the bad times of the year, both ways. And you think about on the way back, a lot of these kids, if they're over the age of 8 to 10, mm-hmm. then they're carrying a 40-liter jerry can, which is I'm thinking in liters now. That's 5 gallons. So it's like your 5-gallon water jug in your office space. That's 40 liters of water. I know that I think it's eight pounds a gallon, I think is what water is. So it's about 40 pounds at least. Think about a 10-year-old kid carrying that, right. All that distance.
And in fact, it is the children and the women
who
do the heavy lifting, the water carrying.
That's correct. And that's actually a good point, because something that upset me when I first got into this is, of course, I definitely believe that we need education in these developing countries. It's really going to help change a lot of this stuff. And so I agree with organizations that are out putting in schools and doing education-type reform, but you can't do anything until these kids stop walking 6 hours a day or 4 hours a day or whatever it is, because they're not going to be in school, because their job is to get up early, walk all the way down to get that water, and walk all the way back. And after their mom has cooked their food and they've done some clothes and helped her out, it's time to go do it again.
Right.
Because they'd have to do it twice a day. So you're not going to get these kids in school until you meet that foundational human right and need of clean water. And then we can start focusing on the infrastructure of education.
You go over there knowing very little about what you have to do or how to do it.
Right.
And you figure out what's needed, and you figure out how to do it, and we'll talk a little bit about how your approach is different. You don't just go over there and put the well in and walk away.
Right. That's
good
great.
Luck. Here you go. Have some fresh water. You teach them how to fix it. You teach them how to do it themselves.
Correct.
But you didn't know how to do it. How come you learned how to do it, and they who live there and walk 6 hours a day to get water didn't find out how to do it?
And that's another great question. And it's very difficult for us to understand. And I have a hard time articulating that, because it's not that these people aren't intelligent. They're extremely intelligent people. They're very resourceful in a lot of things they do. But you know what's crazy? A lot of them don't even associate the disease and the filth and the stuff that's going on with their children, with the constant diarrhea that's killing huge amounts of their children. They don't even associate that with the water. You have to first teach them about hygiene, and that, look, this water that you're drinking is killing your children. It's not some evil spirit. It's not Allah who's mad at you for whatever. It's not anything except for it's dirty. And once you start getting that through their head, well, then you're breaking foundational ideas that, you're breaking through a lot of cultural barriers there. Spiritual issues, all kind of stuff that they feel like, oh, this is a demon that's killing all our children in our air. No. It's dirty water.
Let me ask you a question about something, because I saw some videos of you of doing what you do.
Uh-huh.
And you were standing in an area that seemed to be flooded with about 2 or 3 inches deep of water.
Oh, yeah.
And exactly. You were drilling a well.
That's correct.
And to drill the well, you were filling the mud hole. You were pumping the hole with this water, which you said was filthy. It was
right.
Full of bacteria and viruses and God knows what all, which is making these kids and these people sick.
Correct.
But you were backfilling to get the mud out of the hole so that you could get your drill bit down into the hole and get the fresh water out of the ground
right.
With this dirty water. Why didn't that contaminate the well?
Great question. So let me give you a couple background. That was in Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
Cambodia, you could look at it. Rice fields everywhere, which obviously need a lot of water.
Mm-hmm.
There's water everywhere in Cambodia. So people are like, well, why is that a big area for water need? Actually, it's one of the biggest. And this is another figure that is absolutely astonishing. 74% of all the deaths, total deaths in Cambodia, are water related. That's hugely beats out old age and other diseases. So Cambodia is a horrible place. And it's because of that standing water. What happens is again, it's an ideology. They don't really understand that this water is what's killing our children. So they're going up and it's easy access. It's right there. I mean, it's everywhere. There's water everywhere in Cambodia, but it's poison. It's absolute poison. So with the drill, how we use that, that's called a mud pump. We use that water actually. So we have a rotary drill there that churns up the soil and goes down up to, you know, 100 or more than 100 feet. And as that drill bit is churning up the soil, you have to force water down into that hole to push all the mud out that you
mm-hmm.
churned up.
Mm-hmm.
Or it would just keep, you know, you would churn down, but, you know, all the mud would keep falling back in the hole.
Okay.
So you need that water to force all that sediment out. And what we have to do for a while, it's a great point, is, yeah, all that water we forced down that hole was filthy. So you do have to pump it for quite a while that day after you've, you know, and just make sure all that dirty water that you put down to force the dirt out, you have to make sure that that's all out of there.
You know, this is the 21st century. You and I know that water has to be clean. You and I know that if it's not, all kinds of things can occur. The leaders of these countries, Cambodia, they certainly know.
Of course.
And what is fascinating to me is that the fixes that you bring to these people do not cost a lot of money. I mean, in Cambodia, you drilled 26 wells in 2008. You hope to install 50 wells. Maybe you've already done that. And the cost is remarkably low, $500. In Uganda, you built biosand filters that can rid water of impurities for $100.
Right.
Why isn't this being done by the leaders of Cambodia, by the leaders of these countries?
Well, if you're full of awesome questions this morning, because that's a fundamental problem that I see is wrong with a lot
of organizations. Why aren't we doing it? Why are we fighting wars when we could be putting in wells and saving lives?
That's the question that I don't know the answer to. I don't know much about.
No, I want to hear your answer to the other question. I keep throwing too many questions.
No, that's fine.
But we have to take a break.
No problem.
And so you'll think about the answer.
I will.
We'll come back and we'll be brilliant.
Doc
Henley is our guest, founder of Wine to Water, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is made possible in part today by Project Managers, Inc., leading organizations through major change initiatives using established disciplines and systematic planning and execution. The only thing certain is change. We manage change. .com. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, analysis of President Obama's primetime address to Congress and the nation on health care last night. Guest host Frank Sesno and health care experts discuss the speech and how it may shape debate over a possible overhaul of the health care and health insurance industries. Our guest today, Doc Henley, the founder of Wine to Water, is appearing tonight, as a matter of fact, at 6 o'clock at Dolce Vita in Noda, as part of the World Affairs Charlotte.com, World Affairs Council Magellan Society meeting. And the presentation is free, but if you want to take part in Wine to Water, it's $15 for 5 wines. And you can go for more information to winetowater.org or worldaffairscharlotte.com. We're back in 30 seconds.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack, the Tappert Brothers. Let's say you wanted to support your station with something other than cash.
Well, I'd donate my time.
I have a restraining order against you. The answer is you could donate your used car.
Right. You get a tax deduction, a nice empty driveway, and the station gets the proceeds.
To arrange a pickup, call 1-866-789-TMCP.
TMCP?
Take my car, please.
That's 866-789-8627.
Or go to WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHA. I'm Mike Collins, and in our Spirit Square studios, Doc Henley, the founder of Wine to Water. We're talking about his efforts to bring clean water to areas of the world that don't have access to it or have very limited access to it. And if you'd like to join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or every other way imaginable at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. The question that I left you with, unable to answer before the break, was if you know how to do these things, and if you know, and you know how to do these things so inexpensively, why do these problems exist? Why aren't the leaders of these countries, or the leaders of tribes, or the leaders of the UN, why aren't they doing these things? Why aren't we, the United States, doing these things? It's cheap.
I think we're just coming to an age where we're beginning to, and it's kind of a coined phrase that you'll hear a lot in development, and aid work now, and that people are focusing on sustainable development. Because if you think about, this is how I started coming to the idea of trying to figure out the cheapest way I could do things. Not just because when I started out, I didn't have millions of dollars like everybody else had at these organizations. So I had to work with what I had. But something else that upset me is seeing organizations come, they'll put a $10,000-$12,000 well in Darfur right next to one that is just not working, or near one that's not working that I could just fix for $200 or $300 and get the same outcome of a well that's working. And then I can leave those people with a $50 set of tools and show them how we fixed it so that they can fix it the next time. So we've taken that and applied it.
This is like I don't remember the exact adage, but it's like the old adage, if you give a man food when he's hungry, he'll depend on you, but if you show him how to grow his own food, then he'll never go hungry again.
Yeah, you teach a man to fish. It's that whole idea. Well, there's a couple reasons why I think that fundamentally it's been a problem for a long time, but that it's starting to change, I think. But something that very is disheartening and upsetting to me is there's a lot of organizations, or some organizations out there, that they are run like a business. That is how they are run. And they have a certain percentage that they get over every dollar that comes in. So if they can write a grant for $10 million, some of their percentages that they'll get just on the grants alone, sometimes it's 15, 20%. Well, that's a significant amount of money.
And that money goes where?
Now, let's say it's an organization that's doing all that with water, just for example. Mm-hmm. So let's say they're going to do $10 million. Well, we have to buy two or three drill rigs and drill X amount of wells over the next how many ever years. Well, what happens when you start thinking about people instead of relationally, and when you start thinking of people as numbers and the problem out there as numbers, is that becomes your main driving force. Well, shoot, that gets us $4 million right there to work as an organization and do other things. So then your problem is, well, we got to get all these wells out so that we can do another one, so that we can write another grant or whatever. So the driving force becomes these numbers, these figures, getting the work done, instead of so much, are we doing it well? Are we doing it efficiently? And that's something that I saw huge over and over in Darfur at my first experience. Because there's multi-million dollar drill rigs running around popping holes in the ground that I couldn't even afford to do two of those holes.
Can you do on a large scale, and it seems to me that the problem is big enough in many parts of the world where it should be done on a large scale. Can you do it on a large scale and be relational, build it on relationships as opposed to building it on numbers?
I think so. And I actually think that's where people are starting to go. I don't think this is something that, I just had this idea in Darfur that I start to see, and nobody's caught on to it. No, I mean, I definitely have mentors that have taught me sustainable development is where it needs to go. And there's other organizations attempting to do that. And basically focusing on sustainable development, if it's going to happen, you have to be relational. You have to get on their level and talk to them and train them on what you're doing so that they can do the same thing down the road. And the only way you're going to be effective and invoke a behavior change on a society that really doesn't even understand that the water is killing them, you have to invest time and energy in that relationship with those people. And I do think there's going to be a lot of organizations that are starting that will start to do that.
I read that when you started this, that you went over there and you looked at things that were being done and you stole some ideas, you discarded other ideas, but you fundamentally came away with the decision to do things in a whole new way.
Right.
Is this what you're talking about when you talk about doing things in a whole new way?
That's correct. Like, for example, at the end of 2007 and in 2008, we began drilling in Cambodia, and we did it like anybody else. We kind of used a local rig that was owned by a company that was run by their people. We hired them to go out there, and then we used a UNICEF pump that everybody else in the world uses as well. So you pay a few hundred dollars for the pump, you pay for the contractor to come out, and your well cost out there for that is $2,500, which is pretty, you know, it's not a very deep water table in Cambodia, not very hard soil. That's a pretty average number for a well, $2,500. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm talking with my guys there, and I'm like, well, why can't we have our own drill rig? One, why can't we build it or buy it or piece it together? They said, well, we can. I'm like, well, let's do it. Let's do it. Tell me a price. Give me a budget. Show me everything, and let's do it. And the other idea, why do we have to use the pumps from UNICEF that we have to wait on parts for when they break or go buy more parts from them or from once they get in the market from there? What do the farmers use? If they were to put a well for their farm or their family, would they put in one of those pumps? They said, no, they piece together local materials from PVC piping and some plastic and make their own pump out of materials in the market. I'm like, well, why can't we do that? They said, well, we can. I'm like, well, let's do it. So then we got our cost down from $2,500 to $500.
But isn't store-bought, which would be the UNICEF pump, better than homemade?
Well, that's a great question, because I actually was thinking, well, these things are just going to break more. But no, the guys are saying that generally every 3 to 4 years, you're going to have some issue that needs to be fixed with either one. And the great thing about this piece together pump from the market is that they're already familiar with it. So if we can leave them with the tools and actually have them, another thing we do to save money is they have to be a part of drilling that well. The way I look at it is nothing's free. And that's important because that creates ownership that if the local people are helping to drill their own well, they're the labor, then that creates ownership of that well and training at the same time.
Yeah, they know how to do it now.
Yeah,
they've witnessed
exactly
how it was done. And the parts are there and they're available if they break and they know how to put them together and make
exactly
it. Let's take a phone call. Wally in Charlotte, welcome. You've been holding a long time. Welcome to the program.
Okay. I'm calling. I want to congratulate the young man. I think his name is Doc Henry.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to congratulate him. And I'm a man of faith. As of October, I'll be 75. And I'm Muslim. But what he's saying, what he's talking about, and what he's doing to me is there's a correlation between what he's doing and what our president is trying to do. I watched your president give his address yesterday or last night. And to me, what he's doing is what Jesus would be doing. And I believe it's Christ-like. And I see a correlation between the two. And to come against this kind of work that he's doing or not do it when they have the ability to do it, have the means to do it, as some of the leaders in these places are not doing, is to me antichrist.
Hmm.
Now, someone may have problems with what I'm saying because I identify as Muslim. But they may also be very surprised to find out that Muslims claim and have an association with Jesus as strong as anyone else, maybe even strong. We don't know. We're not interested in competing, but we have a great love for Jesus. And I just wanted to congratulate this young man and cheer him on and just let him, and for him to know that the idea just came to him as he was laying in his bed. Well, that's the way all the progress that we see that has come to humanity that we enjoy, that's the way it came. We also, we may not realize, may be surprised to know that we're not very different than these religions. Believers that's in these religions are not very different.
Well, you said that earlier, pretty much.
Absolutely. And Wally, I can't express to you how much that means to me to hear you say that. That's definitely, it means the world to me. I fell in love with the Muslim culture there in Sudan as a Christian. And that, I could probably catch a lot of flack for saying that. And
why?
People, I don't know.
I mean, I think because of 9/11, we see that part of the world and that religion as being, that religion has been demonized and perhaps demonized by its own people.
Well, even if I said that I fell in love with, and fill in the blank, another religion, a lot of ultra-conservative folks out there would definitely attack me, and I will get attacked. I'm kind of planning on that, but I don't think there's anything wrong with saying I met these people group, lived with them, saw them in their everyday life, and fell in love with those people.
Mm-hmm.
If there's someone that says that there's something wrong with that, and I have nothing to say to them. And Wally, it means the world to hear you say that. And I really do appreciate it.
If I could just share this before I'm off, I know I took some time. I may even get some flack. In fact,
yeah.
I get some flack. Yes, it's a very serious situation with the labels that we carry: Christian, Muslim, Jew. God didn't make anyone, and also we identify as black, white. All these things just divide us. God didn't make these things. We brought these names and these titles to ourselves, except for an understanding in Islam that how the name Muslim came, and Muslim can be associated with any believer, no matter what religion he's identifying, because all it means is to submit your will to God's will.
Wally, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. We're getting a little off track here.
Thank you, Wally.
Because you work in, you've worked in Sudan, you've worked in India,
right?
Ethiopia, Uganda, Cambodia, Haiti. Have you gone to Guatemala yet, or are you going to Guatemala?
No, we're actually our Central South America place that we're going right now, and I'm leaving tomorrow morning, actually, is Peru. We'll be going there. We kind of put a hold on things in Guatemala, but I'm heading to Peru tomorrow morning. There's an orphanage in an area called Trujillo, north of Lima, and there's 74 kids right now that they've taken out of a trash dump, built an orphanage for them. The orphanage is ready to go, ready to rock and roll, ready to house the kids. No water. And they're freaking out. They call me. They got some quote from an organization down there, a company for a $25,000 well that they'll put in for them. And they were freaking out, like, we can't afford that. And I was like, I'll be on a plane. They told me this last week. I'm like, I'll be on a plane next week.
How do you know you can do it?
That's a great question. I really don't know, but I know I'm going straight to the government first. Their local government office that has all the geophysical surveys and that does all the environmental, it's over all the water, because the government down in Peru apparently owns the groundwater or whatever. I'm going to go to them and say, here's a group of people that are bringing 73 kids out of a trash dump that will probably end up hooked on different drugs or causing problems for your community, that they're bringing them out of that. They're teaching them good lessons, teaching them how to be great people and to not go down that path. And you're, as a government, because the actual cost of that well, I've looked at it, it's 50 meters deep. The actual costs are $2,000 to get the parts and labor and materials. But the government is going to charge $23,000 extra for their red tape. And I'm going to say, are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure you want us to start writing and blogging the things about the government of doing this? I think I feel pretty confident that we'll get a little lower number, maybe not $2,000, but lower than $25,000.
What in your life prepared you to be this way, to prepare you to shoulder this? Because you've called this, it's gone from being your passion to being the burden of your life.
Yes, that is correct.
What prepared you for this?
Honestly, I don't think I was prepared. I don't think that I'm even now completely prepared. I have to continue preparing myself constantly because the hurdles that come along, and again, I don't want to deter off the water crisis, but I do think my faith plays a huge role in that. because I don't have all the answers for how I'm going to end up flying to Peru tomorrow and convincing a group of people to not charge an orphanage $25,000 to instead let us take over this well and only charge us X amount. I don't know how it's going to happen, but my faith plays a huge role in making sure that that does happen.
From our blog, Heidi writes, others have dug wells around the world only to have the water become naturally poisoned by arsenic. Is your well water tested to find out if it is safe?
Yeah, great question. And Cambodia is a huge, huge issue. Arsenic is a major problem. We test every single one of our wells. My guys actually wrote me a few months ago saying, you know, we're paying a decent chunk of change to test every well for arsenic. You know, do you still want to keep doing this? Nobody else is doing it. I'm like, well, yeah, we want to do that. We're not trying to kill people. We're trying to save them. So we do test all our wells there in Cambodia because that's where the major – that's one of our biggest spots where arsenic is a problem. We've only found 3 of our wells. Now we're – I think we're up to about 75 wells altogether now. We've found 3 of them that have had arsenic. We've had to close them down, and we're working diligently on a way to figure out how to filter that arsenic.
Is this your life's work, do you think?
This is definitely my life's work. I can't do anything else. I tried when I came home from Darfur to just try to live a different, maybe even quote unquote normal life for a while. And this is what I feel like I've been called to do, and I can't do anything else.
Wow. You told CNN that you're a completely regular guy, that during your entire life, you never excelled at anything except bartending and your ability to create relationships with people. For a guy who's making such a difference, that's a pretty lowball self-analysis. Thanks for your work.
Thank you for having me here.
Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it. Doc Henley is the founder of Wine to Water. Didn't ask you why wine. It could have been martinis, could have been mojitos, could have been a vodka stinger, but it's Wine to Water. Thanks for joining us.
Charlotte.